Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we did that happen, and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost, and so we went digging.
Yeah, we did. We went digging into the ground there. Burn many things we found. That's the wonderful Dar Williams back with us at the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. Another great hour. Thanks to the crew in New York for putting all this together. Got three great guests. Bunch of stuff to talk about from Solartopia. We want to start with a victory. I'm not going to describe this. Jerry Rubin, are you there?
Yes, I am. Harvey,
all right, Jerry. Thank you so much for calling in. And Ace Hoffman, you're with us from California as well.
Yes, I am. Hi, Harvey.
And Michael Keegan from the Heartland in Michigan.
Hello, Harvey.
Hello, Michael. All right, guys. A wonderful trio here to join us on the Solartopia Show. So we always like to start with a victory, and we have had a major victory in the world of nukes this past week. I want to have Jerry Rubin describe it to us. Jerry, you're talking to us from Southern California. Tell us about what has just happened in Santa Monica in great detail, please.
Well, thank you. It's good to be talking to you again, and hi to everybody else. Well, the victory was a really good one for the anti-nuclear movement and for artists and for everybody. We, after a four-year-long, very sometimes difficult campaign, we saved a wonderful 26-foot-tall public art peace sculpture and warning monument in the Santa Monica Civic Center called Chain Reaction. Now, this unique and timely peace monument was created by a legendary political cartoonist named Paul Conrad. He passed away 5 years ago, and he had won 3 Pulitzer Prizes for his work, mostly at the Los Angeles Times. He was controversial, that he was dedicated, and uniquely creative. Anyhow, this wonderful artwork was proposed to be in Santa Monica, and it was a controversy from the get-go. There were some people that were obviously not in favor of the anti-nuclear message.
Well, Jerry, describe the statue and what it looks like.
Well, it's fantastic. And if people want to see what it looks like and see the list of our hundreds of supporters, some of the wonderful, great people like Ed Asner and Martin Sheen and great artists and educators, they can go to SaveChainReaction.com. But I'll tell you what it looked like and still looks like. It's made out of huge copper chain links. It has fiberglass and steel center. It was built in 1991. It's 26 feet tall, 5.5 tons, and it's made of all chains. That's why it's called Chain Reaction, but it also implies that the chain reaction of the nuclear blast. So it's a unique artistic creation, and it's very thought-provoking. It inspires debate. It inspires dialogue. It inspires discussion. Everything that unique public art should. And I feel very honored to have this in Santa Monica, which is a very art-friendly city.
Now, by way of disclosure, I actually spoke at this thing. I guess it was a couple years ago. There was a rally, And Marianne Williamson and Robert Shear were there, and we had, I don't know, a couple hundred people in support of this amazing piece of work. And so I have seen it. It's very, very cool. And so tell us now what has happened with it.
Yeah, and thank you for coming and speaking so wonderfully at that event to commemorate the anniversary of the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And I remember you were there, and Robert Shear, who's been so helpful in saving the sculpture as well, he's the editor-in-chief of Truthdig, truthdig.com. And we also had Ron Kovic. I'm sure everyone knows they made the movie Born on the 4th of July about Ron. He's a paraplegic Vietnam veteran. He was one of the speakers. And again, thank you, Harvey, for coming out. Anyhow,
well, it was my honor. It was really great to be there.
We were at the Santa Monica City Council meeting, and a whole team effort over the past few years raised $100,000. We said, hey, look, because the Arts Commission said we don't have the money. The city was saying it could be dangerous. People were climbing on it. I had personally never seen anyone climbing on it, and there were no signs that said don't climb on this. But anyhow, they wanted to make sure it was safe, and I understand that. And so we raised $100,000. Norman Lear kicked in some money. Veterans for Peace kicked in some money. Most of it was just smaller contributions. When I had my 70th birthday party a while back, we had a fundraising effort at a great place on the Santa Monica Pier called Rusty's and raised thousands of dollars. But it all went to help the city, and the city finally saw what a broad-based community effort there was and how much support there was. So the previous city manager at the time said, we're going to support this, and if it costs more than what you're giving with the $100,000, the city will pay the rest. Now, the interesting part is it was a free gift from Paul Conrad, and it was funded by none other than the late peace philanthropist Joan Kruk, who was the wife, as you know, of the billionaire founder of McDonald's, Ray Kruk. And there's going to be a book, a wonderful book, by an author named Lisa Napoli, who works at KCRW-FM radio here in Santa Monica. And that'll be coming out next year, as well as a feature film about Ray and Joan Kruk that's going to come out next year. And I think Michael Keaton is going to be in that. And so there's a lot of stuff coming out about Joan Kruk, who knew Paul Conrad and was supportive of that initial $250,000 contribution to create Chain Reaction in the Civic Center back in 1991. She did it anonymously at the time, but I thought, and I wrote an op-ed piece for one of the local papers, I thought that it would be good if people knew that she did this generous action. So I outed her, and now people know it was her that made this anonymous contribution, and I think she would be glad that the sculpture was saved. And I know that Paul Conrad's family, his son Dave Conrad, is happy. Paul Conrad.
How much money? Jerry Rubin talked to us from Santa Monica here about the Chain Reaction sculpture, which has been this week saved by the city of Santa Monica. How much money is being estimated that is needed to get the thing back in shape so that it'll last another 30, 40 years?
They've allocated up to $275,000, and that would include a peace garden that'll be placed around the sculpture to keep people from climbing on it, you know, a lot better than the chain link fence they've had around there for the past couple of years. And it'll be sustainable plants. It'll look good. sculpture's been landmarked unanimously ever since 2012. We went to the Landmarks Commission, and they saw this was such a work of art that it was unanimously declared an official Santa Monica City landmark. And so was the land around it. And you remember that green space of land when you were at the rally, Harvey, and that is landmarked as well, and that'll be a peace garden. And there'll be lighting, and that's been funded now, and there'll be a larger signage that'll talk about the work that Paul Conrad did, and hopefully they'll be able to mention the contribution that Joan Kroc made, as well as the information that it's an official city landmark. So this
Wonderful.
Is something that people will be proud to see and be educated by and inspired by.
Ace Hoffman, you're on the line. You live in San Diego area. Have you seen the chain reaction sculpture in Santa Monica?
Only once many, many years ago.
Uh-huh. And Michael Keaton, you're in, Keegan, you're in, I didn't know you were an actor. You're in Michigan. Have you ever seen this thing in Santa Monica?
I think I just saw a slideshow from Gordon Edwards just this past week.
Oh, about that sculpture.
Yeah, is it two concentric semicircles with a statue next to it?
No.
Nope, okay, all right. I'll have to get out there and see it.
Right, we should be offering free trips to Santa Monica to see this thing.
Yeah, give me a call, I'll buy you all a cup of coffee.
Wonderful.
I will do that.
That's excellent. We're gonna have this thing saved. The necessary upkeep up to, I guess it's going to cost about as much to rehab it as it cost originally to build it. But
don't forget that price now, if they had to build it from scratch now, it would obviously be cost maybe three times as much.
Now, they were talking about moving it. Is it going to stay where it is, or is it going to be moved?
Oh, it certainly is going to stay where it is, and that's part of the landmark designation. I know some people would like to get it and just move it off of planet Earth, but that's where it is. It was right in the center of the Civic Center, and where all the government action takes place, and it proudly sits there, and the message that Paul Conrad inscribed on there says, "This is a statement of peace. May it never become an epitaph." It's a warning monument. And it's actually, if you go to the Peace Monuments of the World website that's been listed, someone named Ted Lolis does this. He's based out of Tennessee. It's one of the most wonderful peace monument websites in the world. And Chain Reaction is listed in about a dozen categories. And the person that runs the website said that it's actually one of his favorites. So,
well, congratulations. This is a time of victories. I'm going to talk with Ace and Michael. You're welcome to stay on with us, Jerry Rubin. But we want to wish you great congratulations on saving this thing. I saw it. It's very, very worth saving. And I'm sure that over the, you know, I have seen in New York City, there is a monument to John Lennon, the Imagine Mosaic, which is right off Central Park West, I think in the 70s in Central Park. And, you know, people just go there all the time. It's just a major a place to go. And I know that this monument is not far from the ocean, and it's a really amazing thing to have preserved. And now it'll be, you know, a part of the permanent landscape of the United States of America. So, Jerry and all your cohorts out there in Santa Monica, thank you very much for doing this.
One last thing. I want to thank Ace for all the work he's done to help shut down the San Onofre nuclear power plant. There's always been a connection between nuclear weapons and nuclear power, and we always have to work to educate people about that. So his dedicated efforts have been fantastic. And I do want to mention, we're doing the remembrance for John Lennon on December 8th. It'll be the 35th anniversary of his tragic
passing.
Death.
And are you going to do it at the Peace, at the Chain Memorial here?
We're going to do it in front of Capitol Records at his star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. And we've been doing it every year, and it's a wonderful peace gathering, and we We have people of all ages come there. We have young people, their parents and their grandparents come out, and we want to speak out, you know, against war and against nuclear weapons, but you also want to speak out against these terrible escalation of guns that are going and unchecked, thanks to the all the misleading efforts of the National Reprehensible Association, the National Rifle Association.
Well, thanks again, Jerry. It's a wonderful thing. Anybody going to Santa Monica, to the L.A. area, should really make the trip to see this now-preserved monument. When are they going to start to go in there and do the work, and how long will it take them to get it to where it's supposed to be?
Well, the wheels of government run slow. It's supposed to be next spring, 2016, but you're going to be invited, Harvey and Ace, everybody. Again, that offer for a cup of coffee right nearby there, we'll be there. We'll have a special event, and we want you to be part of it as well.
Wonderful. I will look forward to that. It'll be a great thing.
Hey, great work you're doing, all of you. Is it okay to stay on and listen?
Again. Yes, you're welcome to stay, absolutely. Tell us again the website where people can see what this monument looks like, Chain Reaction.
Absolutely, www.savechainreaction.com. It's a tremendous website, and it was a tremendous community effort. There's so many people that need to be thanked. It would take a five-hour show to do it, Harvey.
Well, thank you, and you're welcome to stick with us, and I will see you at the Chain Reaction Monument, hopefully soon.
Good deal.
All right. Now, so we're going to proceed now. Michael Keegan in Monroe, Michigan, and Ace Hoffman in San Diego have been graciously staying through this, although it's one of those, you know, one of those things where you want to celebrate and really savor the victory. I know this was really hard to do. The city of Santa Monica needed some arm twisting and, you know, to get the extra $150,000 to preserve this thing was a great thing. And not all of our friends in the American public really endorsed the kind of sentiment that's embodied in this wonderful sculpture. But I'm thrilled that it's going to be saved, and I'm thrilled to be able to talk about it on the radio. Of course, Michael Keegan, you're in Monroe, Michigan. There is a statue. There's a statue in downtown Monroe I think we could do without.
Yes,
do you want to describe
certainly.
That one? Tell us about the statue in downtown Monroe, Michigan, will you?
Yeah, that's the statue of General George Armstrong Custer. he happened to marry a woman from Monroe, Libby Bacon, and they erected a statue in his honor, and it's really a disgrace. But...
You gotta admit, you know, it's pretty amazing to be in a town where there's a statue to the hero of the Little Bighorn there, or the goat of the Little Bighorn, I guess we should call him. It's fantastic. And, of course, in Monroe, we have Fermi Unit 2, which is the middle ground between Fermi Unit 1, which melted down and almost exploded on October 6, 1966, and then Unit 3, that they want to build a new reactor in Michigan. It's absolutely insane. How are we doing on stopping? We're going to go to Diablo Canyon in a minute, but how are we doing on stopping Fermi 3?
Well, Fermi 3 got their COLA, that's the Combined Operating License, from the NRC back in May earlier this year. But it took them 6.5 years to go through the process. We staved them off for about 3-4 years. But we've already got them behind construction schedule by 5 years. And
Five years? 5 years. Wow.
They wanted to break ground in January 2011 under something called a limited work authorization. And we pointed out that you've not done an environmental impact statement, and that needs to be in place. But they got the approval from the NRC, the Rubber Stamp Committee, and we are now taking them, we've got them in federal court, appellate court, I believe out of New York, regarding the generation of nuclear waste. because what these nuclear power plants do is they generate nuclear waste. That really is the product, and the byproduct is electricity, which is fleeting. But you're left with this nasty, toxic, high-level nuclear waste for a quarter of a million years. And there's never been an environmental impact statement done on what are they going to do with this high-level waste that looks like they're going to have to store it on site. So every nuke looks like they're going to be a de facto nuclear dump site. And we've got them in federal court forcing them to come forth with an environmental impact statement on that. And after that goes through court, we have two contentions of quality assurance and also the lack of a transmission corridor on the Fermi 3. They put together the project and developed the project for about 3 years without having a quality assurance program in place. And this is in violation of the Atomic Energy Act. And we pointed this out in court. And the ruling from the judges was, well, they weren't applicants until the day they handed in the application, so therefore they're not responsible for a quality assurance program prior to that. So it's always this pretzel logic you got to deal with when you talk about the nuclear power industry. But we've got them staved off right now. I think we're going to have them staved off for another 2-3 years going through the court process. And the economics are crumbling. They are crumbling. A sister plant at North Anna, they want to build a economically simplified boiling water reactor called an ESVWR. It's the same design that Fermi 3 would be, and they were forced to come forward with the cost at down at North Anna. The Public Service Commission said, okay, we need some numbers here. And it came in at $19.3 billion for the North Anna plant. So the Fermi 3 would be above that price tag because cost of labor in Michigan is higher. And also, Fermi 3 would be the first to be built of that model. And the newcomer, the first of any project, is always more expensive than the subsequent projects. So we put them at over $20 billion to build a Fermi 3. I mean, we don't even have to go into the waste issues. Will it work? Will it not work? It's just stupid. Why tie up $20 billion building a boondoggle, which may or may not ever come to fruition, if you took that $20 billion and invested it in renewables and alternatives and conservation, you would get much, much further. So, but we keep hearing about this, it's no greenhouse gases and nuclear is the way to go. Well, they take over a decade. The Fermi 2 took 20 years to build. So these plants would not be coming online to save the day on greenhouse gases. It's really tying up your resources in a very peculiar way. And really the major costs involved, other than the environmental cost, are the opportunity cost. Because you can't spend that $20 billion on renewables and alternatives if you've sent it down a rat hole of the nuclear power industry. Regarding the monument, congratulations on that. The Fermi 1 was a predecessor of the Fermi 3 and Fermi 2. And I reviewed archives, and I find that the objective of the Fermi 1 was to produce weapons-grade plutonium, suitable for fissionable weaponry. So it was a hidden agenda. The genesis of nuclear power is in nuclear weapons, and the rest of it is just a sort of a dog and pony show to justify the existence in this pursuit of these technologies. I would argue that we're really looking, what we're talking about is nuclear fascism. We are, the ultimate coercive tool is the nuclear bomb. And you look at some of the early definitions of fascism is ruled by the fascist acts, ruled by coercion. And so it's just a terrible technology. It's undemocratic. It sucks the life out of everything. And we need to move on. Did I lose you?
Oh, I'm here, Dave. Mike, it's just mesmerizing to hear you talk about this. Because Fermi 3, I think people have to understand The Fermi 3 is at the site in Monroe, Michigan, which is about 35 miles south of Detroit. On October 6, 1966, the place almost blew up. It's the subject of a very, very important book called We Almost Lost Detroit by John Z. Fuller. And here they are. They lose Unit 1 at a cost of $100 million. They've been operating Unit 2, which is a nightmare, and now they think they want to build Unit 3. Have they broken ground on Unit 3?
No, they have not broken ground. They wanted to break ground in January 2011, and we blocked them. So now they're in a holding pattern. They're saying, well, we've got the license in hand. We're just going to wait for the right opportune time. Well, part of the right opportune time is they're currently at the state regulators and introducing legislation in the House and Senate that would lock in all the customers for 15 years that they would have to either purchase from Detroit Edison or from Consumers Power and not have a choice, essentially solidifying monopoly on where you can purchase your energy from. And years ago, they moved to a deregulated market at the behest of the two utilities, saying, oh, we need to move to a deregulated market. But we're the injured party, so we have to be compensated $4 billion in order to make that transition. Well, about 7-8 years later, they say, well, we've picked up the tokens on that game. Let's change the board game now. And it seems like every 8, 10 years, they change the regulation. And lo and behold, there's always a windfall profit there for the utility. And our relationship to these utilities, I would argue, is one of feudalism. It's a feudal economic order. Our relationship is one of indebtedness and dependency. We don't have a choice, and we can't afford the price, but yet that's what we have to pay for. So it's an economy that does not serve the people. And it's certainly in the interest of the stockholders, but not in the interest of the ratepayers.
Well, I think, frankly, that Fermi 3 will never be built. I think you guys are doing a great job. The question is, when can we get Fermi 2 shut down? And, that's an incredibly dangerous, ridiculous operating nuclear plant. It needs to be shut as soon as possible, like all the rest of them. And, Michael, you are our lone wolf there in Monroe, Michigan. And I know you spend a lot of your time looking at documents that come from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. I want to ask Ace Hoffman. Ace, you're in San Diego, and you are in a place where we have shut two reactors in the recent time. We can celebrate that victory along with the chain reaction victory. Tell us what's happening at San Onofre, the two reactors that we have successfully shut.
Well, of course, they were shut down because the engineers at Southern California Edison did not design the steam generators properly. So less than a year after Unit 3's steam generators were installed, they sprung a leak, and the reason was because they were vibrating excessively. And this should never have happened. But if you don't do your math right, then these are the kinds of consequences. And, of course, problems like that happen all the time at reactors, and they don't always end so nicely as they did here. So since the plant shut down in January 2012, a year and a half later, after they collected over hundreds of millions of dollars in ratepayer fees, as if they were still running, so that they could pay the engineers that were working at the plant for doing nothing, they finally decided that they would indeed shut it down permanently, forever. And
Make that announcement?
They made that announcement in around June or July of 2013. So since that time, everyone has kind of come together on one thought, which is, well, now we've got to get the waste out of here. And that's been a very a futile battle, because the activists, many of them want to try to send it to an interim storage site. Others want Yucca Mountain to reopen, and a couple of them realize it's not going to go anywhere, and are trying to get stronger dry casks, because a typical dry cask is only about a half inch thick, maybe 5/8, and it's an enormous stainless steel canister the size of a small school bus, and it's vulnerable. It's vulnerable to airplane strikes. It's vulnerable to terrorism. It's vulnerable to tsunamis. It's vulnerable to earthquakes. And the waste is just going to sit here for hundreds of years. The NRC is talking about leaving it on site for 300 years at every reactor site. Because
300 years?
Yeah, they license it for, I think it's 40 years at a time, and the first 40-year license is going to practically be automatic, and the rest of them, they don't have a good way to inspect them, and there's no way to inspect the inside. You can only take a look and see if there's cracks on some parts of the outside, and even that's not very easy to do. The stress points are going to be where the cast, these things weigh, you know, hundreds of thousands of pounds. It's going to be where the weight is sitting on a, you know, on a stand of some sort, and getting in there and looking at the welds and seeing if they're starting to crack. It's just not possible. They don't have the technology. But yet they still expect to hold them here for hundreds of years.
Now, Michael Keegan, you in Monroe, Michigan, have had the experience of dealing with a shut reactor. It's been shut for almost 50 years now. Fermi Unit 1. Is there anything you can tell Ace, who's out there dealing with San Onofre, about how to deal with a shut reactor?
Well, the Fermi 1 is still radioactive. The site is still radioactive, and it's there's tritium on site. But we did have some experience with the dry cast over at the Palisades nuclear plant. In fact, we had the Attorney General of the state of Michigan representing us in the sixth appellate court down in Cincinnati, and we moved for a temporary restraining order on loading these things because we said there's irreparable harm to be done. And we filed, I think, on May 3rd, and the judge said, okay, I'm going to hear it on May 5th. And on May 4th, the utility came forward with a document on the unloading process, and essentially they slapped together a quick brochure how they would unload, just reverse the process. But lo and behold, and so we couldn't get a temporary restraining order because they argued it's not irreparable because we can unload these. Well, a year and a half later, we learned that a cask has never been unloaded. It's never been done. It can't be done because if they would have to do it underwater, and there would be a huge steam flash because of the decay heat from these fuel rods. So what they're really doing is teeing up a situation where it's irreparable harm to be done, and these casks are just not robust. It's really a derelict and criminal behavior. So that's been our experience on the dry cask. And there, I'm here in the Great Lakes Basin, and which is ringed by 37 nuclear power plants right in the watershed. Another 23 in the windshed, but many of those reactors have the dry cask sitting on the shore of the Great Lakes. 20% of the world's surface fresh water are being put in jeopardy for the utility's bottom line, which is continued production. They don't know what to do with it. They'll figure it out later. A lot of people argue, oh, Yucca Mountain, that's so sad that it was it failed. Well, Yucca Mountain was a tremendous success because it kept the lie alive that they got something and they got a place to put it, the illusion of a solution. That's what Yucca Mountain was. And now all this, you know, back and forth, it still keeps the lie alive. We've got to stop the production of this poison power.
So what has happened to the fuel from Fermi Unit 1? Is it just sitting there in dry casks?
No, it went to Inel, Idaho. And then there were barrels and barrels of sodium, which is explosive if it hits water or air, and that had to be shipped out as well. They did a rapid disassembly of the plant. The workers all got crapped up, and within a few short years, out of a pool of workers of 39, 35 of them came down with cancers of the organ, different organs, and passed on. Died.
Oh my God!
So, but nobody knows that, and that's all suppressed, and nobody wants to talk about it. Oh, I could tell you these things, but I won't because we could squeeze one more job out of the place. It's a conspiracy of silence,
and they dangle the money in front of communities that have limited resources, and everybody capitulates. You know, what's as disheartening as, you know, the terrible tragedy that could occur if there were an accident is how a community sells their soul to the utility, and everybody just rolls over.
So, Ace, I'm sure this resonates with you. The Fermi 1 reactor was must have been the first to be shut down, I mean, involuntarily. But I don't think Shippingport closed later. And so we've got guys here with the most recently closed reactors talking to the long-term shutdown. What are you seeing happening now at San Onofre? Is there any resolution between the three opinions of A, leaving it there, B, shipping it, you know, all these different places? I mean, what's going on in terms of the politics of it? And I know also, by the way, there's been quite a bit of back and forth in terms of Southern California Edison coming up with bad numbers about who should be paying for this. Can you fill us in a bit on that?
Bad numbers about what? I couldn't quite hear that.
The Southern California Edison has been fudging the numbers at San Onofre, as I'm sure that they did at Fermi 1, to avoid responsibility for paying for these things.
One of the first tricks that they all do is there's a decommissioning fund that every reactor has, and they never let that fund be fully funded, because if they did, it would be rather easy to say, well, why don't we just shut it down? We've got the money. So when the reactor shut down unexpectedly, of course, they were, you know, billions of dollars short on how much money they would need. And exactly how much money they were short, well, that's where they start fudging the numbers. Do you include the lost income because the reactor shut down so early, or do you include the cost of the replacement fuel? Do you include, you know, there's just a lot of different choices that the utility can make. And they're trying to get some money back from the steam generator manufacturers. And does that go to the shareholders, or does it go to the ratepayers, or does it go directly to SCE to lower the cost of something? I don't think they'll get any money from Mitsubishi, the steam generator manufacturer, but that's the kind of shenanigans that they're pulling. It's just a complete financial boondoggle here, to the tune of about $10 billion.
Well, let's explain this thing with Mitsubishi, because we always love it when corporations are suing each other. Southern California Edison contracted with Mitsubishi in Japan to bring in new steam generators, and somebody played games with the design of the new steam generators, and they put in steam generators that had been, and correct me if I'm saying something wrong here, is they put in steam generators that had been altered and thus were not in compliance with their license. And then they played games with the license, and that was one of the avenues by which the opposition was able to shut them down. Isn't that right?
Well, the opposition didn't actually get to shut them down. They shut them down themselves. But, the alterations were billed as or promoted as a like-for-like replacement, which apparently means nothing more than that the connections are in the same place. But everything inside the steam generators was completely different. The length of the tubes was different. The number of tubes was different. There used to be a stay cylinder in the middle for support and also to allow water to flow up, cooler water to flow up the middle, so that when it got to the top of the steam generator, there would still be mostly water and, you know, and steam instead of just steam. Because when there's just steam, that's when the tubes can vibrate. The water has a dampening effect. So they did all these and many more changes, and yet they told the public and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission that it was a like-for-like change. And Southern California Edison forced Mitsubishi to not talk to the NRC without Southern California Edison's permission and a presence. So there's no question who was really at fault here. Southern California Edison basically designed the reactor, the new steam generators, or they gave the specifications for the exact design to Mitsubishi, and then said, build it. So who's at fault?
So Mitsubishi is claiming that they didn't do anything wrong; they just followed orders.
Yeah, basically, they might have made a mistake in a number here and there, but Southern California Edison had every chance to check these numbers, and it was their duty to check these numbers. And I must say, it was the NRC's duty, above all, to make sure that the steam generators being put in were safe, and they did not do their job.
Mind-boggling. We're talking with Ace Hoffman from San Diego, who's been instrumental in shutting down the San Onofre nuclear reactors, and Michael Keegan in Monroe, Michigan, who's been just totally on the case for decades at the Fermi reactors in 45 miles south of Detroit. The San Onofre reactors are in between Los Angeles and San Diego. I've seen them many times on the train going up and down, and it's just such a great thing that they're finally shut. It's really spectacular. And, of course, Fermi 1 in Monroe is shut down. Let's talk about what we hope are the next two reactors, or among the next two reactors to shut down, the two at Diablo Canyon, which are up at San Luis Obispo, between L.A. and San Diego and San Francisco. Ace, what's the latest that's happening at Diablo Canyon? I know, Michael, you were looking through some NRC documents and looked at some stuff from Diablo Canyon. What are we expecting from these two reactors surrounded by earthquake faults?
I have the names of the faults that surround. Within 10 miles, there's the Hosbury Fault, the Edna Fault, the Los Osos Fault, the San Miguelito Fault, the San Luis Bay Fault, and the Shoreline Fault. All of those faults are within 10 miles of the Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant. But the PG&E managed to find some seismologists who said that they don't expect a significant earthquake within the next 10,000 years. Maybe. There probably won't be too significant of an earthquake. And so earlier this year, they said that they had completed their seismic studies and everything looks fine. So they've decided to reopen their relicensing procedure. You see, what nuclear power plants do is they wait for the right political moment to start to relicense a plant. And Diablo Canyon was so comfortable with the idea that 13 years before their 40-year license ran out, more than 13 years, they started to do the process of applying for a new license. And the next thing that happened was Fukushima, and after that, they withdrew their relicensing application. And then a couple of years, now we're 4 or 5 years after Fukushima, and they're starting it up again, although they still are 8 years. The first reactor will need to be relicensed by 2024, and the other one 2025. And so, we're, 8, 9 years prior to that now, 10 years prior to that, and yet they're starting this relicensing process because they think this is a good time.
Yeah, well, I guess they want to avoid what's happening at Indian Point, north of New York City, where you have Indian Point Unit 2. Their license has expired, and Indian Point 3's license is about to expire. Michael, have you come up with any new items here on Diablo Canyon in terms of NRC reporting?
Well, there's embrittlement at Diablo Canyon, and embrittlement is when the metal in the reactor gets bombarded with radiation. It loses its flexibility, called ductility, and it's subject to shattering when there's a sudden change of temperature. And when you have to go into emergency shutdown, you have to flood the reactor, and so you do have a sudden change in temperature. So the embrittlement at Diablo Canyon is bothersome, and it's a crapshoot. But these companies are all operating under something called Price Anderson. I think you reviewed that a number of times. But they're indemnified by the federal government, by the taxpayers. So they're off the hook. And many of these companies are moving to become a limited liability corporation. And the NRC gives them blessings to do so. Essentially, the NRC is aiding and abetting criminal negligence. So should they have an accident, they say, well, it's on your land. I guess we just got to walk away from it. I did want to mention that we have similar issues at Davis-Gussie on these steam generators, as did San Onofre. Davis-Gussie did their steam generator replacement. They did it in-house with their own engineering under something called a 50-59 process that the NRC says, okay, this is same for same, like for like, so it doesn't require our high-level scrutinization. So go ahead and do it, boys. We hired Arne Gunderson to come in and take a look at Davis-Gussie, and he found that the replacement steam generators were very, very different than what they were replacing. So it remains to be seen, you know, they've been operating about a year. It remains to be seen if the same problems that occurred at San Onofre occurs at Davis-Gussie.
So what you're saying is that San Onofre, which was shut down, in large part because of a license violation, the same license violation has happened at the Davis-Gussie nuclear plant, which is near Toledo. Is that right?
Well, no, not a violation. The NRC allowed them to do it in a very without providing the oversight, because they said it's the same for same. If I were to replace my front porch, I would not have to get a building permit because I'm doing the same for same. And so that's essentially what they were arguing. But what they did is they replaced the steam generators at San Onofre with very different pieces of equipment, and they've done the same at Davis-Gussie without doing the engineering oversight, without the scrutinization. So they bought themselves a problem of their own making out at the San Onofre, and may have done so at the Davis-Gussie. And what's frightening is, well, I mean, you know, an accident is certainly frightening, but the dynamics at Davis-Gussie are they are currently before the Public Utilities Commission of Ohio seeking a $3 billion bailout where they're going to put the ratepayers on the hook for another 15 years with faulty equipment potentially installed, without having done the scrutinization of this equipment. The same kind of metal used out at San Onofre, this Inconel 690, with more tubes installed. Same dynamics going on at Davis-Gussie. So it remains to be seen whether these steam generators crap out at Davis-Gussie as well. So it's an industry without any oversight.
Yeah, it's an interesting dynamic. Have you followed Davis-Gussie at all?
Pardon?
Ace Hoffman, are you aware of the situation at Davis-Gussie?
Yeah, somewhat. That metal that they're using for the tubes, the alloy 690, it has a 10% less heat coefficient than the old alloy 600 that they were using. And so that's part of why San Onofre made the tubes longer and added more tubes, was to compensate for that difference. But that took up a lot of the room inside the steam generator, so the steam mixture and the water mixture couldn't mix properly, and it overheated. And obviously, Davis-Gussie is doing the same thing in terms of not, it's not a like-for-like change at all. I mean, a 10% difference is enormous.
Yes.
Wow. You know, these guys just don't care. You know, they just do whatever the hell they want. I'm so happy they got caught at San Onofre. I just don't know what the dynamic is going to be here in Ohio to get this reactor done. I happen to think that, you know, in my limited technical knowledge, that Davis-Gussie is probably the most dangerous reactor in the United States in terms of being decrepit. I mean, this is a reactor where boric acid ate through the shield, where they've cut off the head of Davis-Gussie, what, three times now? Replaced the lid on the reactor pressure vessel. I mean, you know, this thing is held together with duct tape, Davis-Gussie. I don't know of another reactor in the world that is, well, we don't know about some of the other ones around the world, but in the United States where it's been, when pasted and cut and shredded like Davis-Gussie, it's insane.
Yeah, they had to cut into the shield building to bring the new reactor head in. And Davis-Gussie, they cut four holes over the career of the plant, four holes into the shield building, And on the last cut, they found that, oh, my God, it's got laminar cracking. It's got cracking throughout. And then they minimized this. Oh, this is just surface cracking. Well, December 2011, a couple of NRC engineers are saying there's a chance that 90% of the shield building, which weighs about between 20,000 and 25,000 tons, could come crumbling down around the secondary containment. And that got suppressed, and they said, well, go ahead and restart anyway. Their root cause analysis said it was the blizzard of 1978. It was so cold and the water was driven so hard that it penetrated the concrete, and that led to laminar cracking, just surface cracking. And so our fix is going to be, we're going to whitewash it. We're going to put a sealant on it, and we advised them not to do so at the time, and it turns out the sealant that they put on has now locked in the moisture, and now they're into another dynamic of freeze-thaw cycles where the concrete is starting to crack and cracks with each freeze-thaw cycle, which is 30 to 40 a year.
It's terrifying. It's really terrifying to hear this stuff.
Am I still on?
Yes.
This is Jerry Rubin. I just wanted to say it is horrifying. I remember when I first got involved in 1979 protesting against the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant, a group, the Alliance for Survival, and all the stuff we did and getting arrested there. There was an article in today's LA Times talking about how green nuclear power is. We need to get rid of all the nuclear power plants. There's someone on my street that has a bumper sticker, another environmentalist for nuclear power. And with all the climate change and talking about getting rid of coal and other carbon-producing energy sources, we have to be careful. We can't let the administration be supportive of nuclear power. It's dangerous. It always will be. From the mining, the milling, the processing of the uranium, we don't know what to do with the nuclear waste. It's costly. It's deadly. We had a bumper sticker, you might recall. It said, better active today than radioactive tomorrow. We need to bring that back by popular demand. We need to keep protesting, and we need to keep speaking out against nuclear power. And I want to thank Ace and everybody for the work they've done. I remember when we were working to try to stop San Onofre, until Ace came aboard and all the other people working with him, we weren't really successful. But now it is, so we can't give up on that. It's just too important for our future.
Well, what happens now in the anti-nuclear movement is, you know, we're dealing with old reactors. I think the idea of building new reactors is really, its days are limited even to be a conversation piece. But these old reactors are just crumbling. And, David Spezia, I think, is the most hair-raising, but there's plenty of stories around, including Diablo Canyon here in Ace's backyard and yours, Jerry, where you got two reactors that are surrounded by, they keep finding new earthquake faults. It's amazing. And,
absolutely.
You know, I have to say, I took one for the cause. I went to see that movie, San Andreas, a whole 90-minute feature film, excruciating to watch. Doesn't mention a thing about the San Andreas fault going off. Doesn't have a single word in it about nuclear power. And the Diablo reactors are 45 miles from the San Andreas fault, which is half the distance that Fukushima was from the earthquake that destroyed it. So, we're dealing with just really terrifying stuff. Ace, what's the prospects for shutting Diablo at this point in time?
I don't know. I was hoping that when San Onofre shut down, we could take all of the activists that have been working on San Onofre and convert them into Diablo Canyon activists, because I think that's our most dangerous, our highest risk from anything nuclear in this area, although there are a lot of nuclear submarines and aircraft carriers, too. Although I believe those reactors are a bit more robust. which makes Diablo Canyon our greatest threat, even 200 miles away down here. Fukushima was not the worst accident that a reactor can have. It could have destroyed Tokyo, and it didn't, fortunately. But terms of Diablo Canyon, I couldn't get the activists, not many of them, to switch over. Most of them turned to trying to get the dry casks out of here to Yucca Mountain or to an interim storage site and getting the fuel out of the pool and into the dry casks, the different versions of what they were on, but they're basically staying in their local, NIMBYism. Even the activists are.
Don't give up, Ace. I know there's people that would still want to be supportive, and it just takes a little bit, that never give up thing. I know you are an activist of that caliber, and we just owe it to the environment and to Mother Earth.
Canyon. I've been going up to Diablo Canyon for their meetings and, for NRC hearings and things like that. And there's a very small group of pro-nuclear environmentalists, as they call themselves. And they're very friendly people out in California. That's kind of the way people are. And I gave them a copy of my book, Code Killers, which is available online at my website. You can download it for free, acehoffman.org. And I basically begged them to comment on it. And I mentioned the dangers of tritium when I spoke up there, and the pro-nuker said he was going to tear me apart on tritium. And that's been 3 months. I'm still waiting. I've asked them multiple times. Go ahead. Come on. Come at me.
Yeah, well, the industry is becoming more and more desperate, but they are still powerful. And I have terrifying news in the last few weeks that China may be moving ahead with as many as 300 reactors, at least according to one news report. And certainly they have not pulled the plug on the nuclear program in China, which is just...
So it's like the China syndrome come true.
Well, it's worse, actually. So, but listen, guys, we are almost out of time. Michael Keegan, can you tell people how to get in touch with you?
Well, let's see. I can give you my email address. M. Keegan, that's M-K-E-E-G-A-N, J@comcast.net.
Okay, and Ace, so great, Jerry Rubin, thank you so much. Ace Hoffman, Jerry Rubin, and Michael Keegan, we'll be back next week. In a
thank you, Harvey, thank you, Ace.
Thank you, guys in
thank
New York as well.
Bye, Harvey.
Take care.
We bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost, and so we went digging into the ground and started to burn.